Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Don and Dude.
We've come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass, and we're all out of bubblegum. It's from a wonderful movie called They Live with Roddy Piper.
Yes.
It's stupid, but pretty awesome at the same time. This is the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Don with me. Don, 1988. We're rolling through these 80s a little too fast.
Yeah, we're almost done. Just two more years to go.
Wow, great insight.
I like to, put things into perspective.
Yes, yes. I like to bring the room down. So as we said, this is the Album Nerds Podcast, and we love albums, the album format, talking about them. And we've got a great show for you today, as always, I hope. We are continuing our I Love the 80s journey, and we're all the way to 1988. Don and I will each be presenting an album today from the R&B and metal worlds from 1988, as dictated by the Wheel of Musical Discovery. Then, of course, Don will be asking us a deep question. We'll have some shout-outs at the end of the show. We'll have some shout-outs to some other albums and album-related items we're digging, mostly new releases and stuff like that. And then we'll spin the Wheel of Musical Discovery to find out what kind of albums we'll be talking about in 1989, the final year of our I Love the 80s journey. But today, my friends, it's all about
1988. That's what I'm talking about!
Super Mario hops into his third adventure. Roseanne barges onto primetime with sharp one-liners. A barefoot cop clamors through office tower vents.
Welcome to the party, pal.
Yippee-ki-yay. Tom Cruise flips liquor bottles. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Cocktail. Yeah.
And an animated rabbit warps reality. Today, one of us slides on a silky slice of R&B and the other cranks a metal monster that shook 1988. So lace up your high tops, swing by your local video store, and grab a box of Teddy Grahams. This is 1988.
Can we start pumping our high tops where the Reebok pumps out?
Yeah, I think this was around that
time. They come a little later.
I feel like a lot of people didn't even lace their high tops, or you'd only do like three.
Right, the bottom part. Yeah. So there were quite a few things to consider here. We were hamstrung to some degree, as we had talked about a few of these albums over the years on the show. In the R&B space, Bobby Brown, that's probably the biggest one, Don't Be Cruel.
Yeah, we did that one.
When New Jack went in the really full swing.
Can't sleep at night, I toss and turn.
Well, it's uncanny. His old band, New Edition, had come out with an album, Heartbreak. They had kicked him out of Bobby Brown out of the band and brought in, I think Johnny Gill was his replacement.
Okay. Yeah, so there's another Sade record, which we passed up. Another good one called Stronger Than Pride.
Yeah, I like that one.
Yeah, and Anita Baker, I think, has come up a few times. So this was Giving You the Best That I Got. I remember that winning Grammys.
Yeah, that was a good record. And that was on the show at some point. It might have been before your time. Or was that the one we talked about?
We did the other one.
Okay. the heavy metal space, we had Metallica and Justice for All, which we've covered on the show. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to ration our Metallica time because we could just have a whole Metallica show probably. Iron Maiden's Seventh Son of a Seventh Son.
We did that one too.
We did, but concept album, progressive metal type of stuff going on there. So
Slayer, that's another one of those. What are they? The Holy Four, or what are they called? The Big Four.
Big Four. Oh, okay, yeah, I know. it's not that great of a brand name, but
right. And then what's it? Halloween.
Ah, yes. Yeah, they're like a power metal type of things, and they're German. I guess you would throw that in sort of with your Iron Maidens and things of that nature.
Okay. So is it Halloween?
Yeah, could be. Certainly a lot to choose from, and some things that were verboten, as the Halloween guys might say. <That's good. laughs> But the picks are in. The Zoltar machine is fired up.
Oh,
yes. It's time to get big with our cha-cha-cha choices.
You choose me?
My R&B album comes from Al B. Schur, and often with an exclamation point.
Schur is such an interesting last name.
Yes. It's a Greek. Is it? So the album is called In Effect Mode. Albie Shore was born Albert Joseph Brown III. Born in Boston, but you know, raised in Mount Vernon, New York. Singer, songwriter, producer. Kind of part of this, the early stages of New Jack Swing. I believe was discovered by Mr. Quincy Jones. Is it cool. Sir Quincy Jones?
It certainly should be.
So, yeah, this is his debut album. He works with, I think he's his cousin, Kyle West. I think they're related.
That's what I read as well.
Yeah, who's also a, you know, a producer and musician. Got this suave, sensitive male lead delivery going. Let's get right to it.
Okay.
Here's Night and Day.
Yeah, I feel like I have to throw a lot of emphasis on everything because Albie Shore's name ends with an exclamation point.
Good point. I never really got good at dancing to this kind of thing. Like, if you're not cool, you can't really dance to it, I think.
If you're not cool, there's no cool when it comes to dancing. You just dance.
That's true. So Night and Day was written by Shore and Kyle West, kind of built around a mid-tempo groove. Soft drums, warm bass, some nice keyboard chords there, stuff that, you know, kind of hints at things that I like from that era. You've got the lyrics, you know, it's about romantic attraction, you know, loving somebody or being attracted to them night and day. What do you think about Night and Day?
It feels like the successor to things like we talked about Ready for the World.
Yes.
Not too long ago. This was recorded kind of like homespun recording, right? I mean, like bedroom production type stuff,
yep.
Sort of like what Ready for the World was doing. This, of course, is moving the sound forward. Things are changing from what was happening in 85 even to where we are now. Things like New Kids on the Block were breaking big. So a lot of the emphasis was on the romance stuff coming from younger artists.
Yeah.
And Al here was what, like, in his teens, late teens.
He was a youngster.
So I guess Kyle wrote the music in January of 87 and kind of left it to sit. And then Al heard it, wrote a chorus. And the story is that Al went to McDonald's to get breakfast and completed the lyrics on a napkin.
So, oh, nice.
I guess, you know, McDonald's can be very inspiring.
I love McDonald's breakfast.
Have you ever created a hit song while being at McDonald's?
No, but I've created some interesting sandwiches back when I worked there. One of the cool things about doing this, I love the 80s experiment, is, you know, we're sort of tracing the evolution of these genres. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you can really hear how this does follow in order, you know, from Ready for the World. And then, you know, like Belle Biv DeVoe is coming next.
Yes, you could definitely hear some of that. The beats and stuff are, there's a lot of shared sounds within these different groups and whatever that I didn't necessarily notice at the time. I mean, the lyrically, it's not, I mean, it was written on a napkin at McDonald's, but it's Al's voice, like great voice, great vocal layering. I don't know how they made it sound so good, but, you know, lines like making love in the rain is fine. I love you more in the rain or shine. Like, that's cute.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it only works because he's so damn smooth.
Right. Yeah. Of course, Night and Day is a famous Cole Porter song.
Sure.
So it's kind of bold to, you know, write a song with the same name.
Yeah. I'm sure the you know, kids that love this gave a crap about Cole Porter.
All right. Well, let's move on to another cut. Here's Off on Your Own.
That's right, girl. I like how the beat is created, like enhanced with his little scatty Off on Your Own Girl thing, where that's almost the music.
Yeah. So this one, again, is written by Shure and West. Lyrics about, you know, an emotionally distant partner, you know, kind of, I guess, going off on her own. You know, it's interesting. These songs, they don't shift a lot in terms of like the dynamics, or, you know, there's not, you know, big moments where they're changing chords or anything. And I think that actually kind of helps in just maintaining a mood throughout.
Well, there's a palette, right? And they don't really diverge from that color palette. Yeah. They stay, but then that's the consistency. That's what makes the tracks connect, even though like lyrically, there's really no connective tissue.
Yeah. Yeah. So in a way it's like the tracks are, it makes them sort of unspectacular, but I think it helps the overall feel of the album.
I agree. Yeah. The vibe. It's a vibe record.
Yeah, I would say that.
This was one of the pre-record deal songs. They had four songs, I guess, that helped them secure their signing. It's sort of ambiguous, but I think it's okay.
Sure.
Danceable. It's a little more up-tempo, and I do enjoy the up-tempo songs on this. None of them get out of control up-tempo, though.
That's
true. They only go up to about 7, not 11, right. And that's as fast as they get.
Yeah, and you hear, I mean, there are hints of hip-hop. I mean, there's a little bit of kind of spoken word stuff, but it's not embracing hip-hop, I think, as much as like the Bobby Brown record from that year.
Right. No, it isn't. And Bobby did some rapping in there too. There's no rapping on this per se. Although, like, if you can do the Running Man to any of the songs, then I say you got a winner. And you can't. You can definitely do that to this song.
All right. Well, was there a track you wanted to highlight?
Yes, sir. If I'm Not Your Lover.
If I'm not your lover, if I'm not your friend.
Put a little stank on it there. Love that.
Yes.
This is the Teddy Riley track, the one that he actually did have some production involvement in. I guess he did work on another one with them called You Can Call Me Crazy, but it was cut and later appeared on an album by the group Guy on their self-titled record in 88. Apparently, Al did contribute some backing vocals that were uncredited. That's the word out there. Sure. This was written by L.B. Shearer and Timmy Gatling. Gatling was Riley's partner in Guy, the group Guy.
Oh.
It's a little harder, cleaner, kind of in the same area where our last featured song was Running Man. Thumbs up. Yes, it can be done. But it's kind of like a lyrically, like, if I'm not your lover, then who is? Like, it's, you know.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, who is he?
Right.
That was the vibe I got from it. No, possessive without being aggressive, territorial without being threatening. There's nothing threatening about any of this. It's all kind of like, you know, I guess teenagey in terms of the uncomplicated approach to relationships and dating. It's still all very simple at that age, you know?
Right. Unlike that Womack and Womack record that was very...
They were very complicated. Yes. But Teddy Riley's production shows here. It definitely is a little more clangy, a little more New Jack Swing sounding than some of the others.
I do like the use of keyboards and synths. I'm not sure that there's guitar at all on this album, or if it is, it's like a sampled guitar on a keyboard.
Yeah, this does not rely on like actual samples. It is, I think, entirely a room full of keyboards. You know, making beats and layering vocals, and Al being able to, I guess he wasn't very experienced at this point as a professional singer or anything, but they did a great job layering his vocals and his harmonies and the little he's and who's and the little Michael Jackson touches just enough, not rip-off sounding, but you know, some of his vocals do have a Jackson quality, I think.
All right. Well, this is the first time this has ever happened to us since we started.
This is weird.
So the closing cut is actually Night and Day again, but this time in Spanish. So it's, is it Noche y Día? Is it I, E, Día? I never took Spanish.
It's E.
E. Okay. So Noche y Día.
It's so weird that they included it on the album, like as a real track, not a bonus. Yeah. Or
and the single to Night and Day, the B-side, is actually a French version of it, which I didn't have a chance to listen to.
No, me either. They must have anticipated that this was going to be a hit, or at least had high hopes, because you don't prepare other language versions unless you think there's an audience for it.
Yeah. And, you know, surprisingly, it's the backing track is not exactly the same. I think they had to change it a little bit because of the phrasing in Spanish is just a little bit different. Well, we have had times, I think, where an album ends with like a reprise or reprise or something of, you know, something that came earlier. Like you could look at this as sort of being a bookend, you know, to the album. Yeah. Is it an artistic statement or, you know, are they just kind of running out of songs?
Well, they did throw in Te Amo in there. I love you. Did you hear that? Which it wasn't part of the lyric on the original, right?
Yeah, sure.
I'm not saying that is like the, you got to have the additional track for. I think they were a couple of young dudes making an album on their own for the most part, and they ran out of stuff.
Yeah, it could be.
I mean, of the 9 total tracks, 7 are original English compositions. There's a cover and a translation, and it's still only 38 minutes.
Yeah.
But it's really, again, it's more vibes. And even if you listen to those songs back to back, like the 2 versions, it's about Al's singing and the, you know, what later came PM Dawn sort of vibiness of it. You know, the flow of it, the romantic flow comes from just the way he's singing and the cadence, and it works.
Yeah, PM Dawn, it definitely has that vibe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's rewind and reflect on Albie Shore's In Effect Mode. I'll begin with my headline. Late night falsetto fantasies get a new Jack makeover.
Yeah, I've had a lot of late night falsetto fantasies. I don't know about you.
But yeah, you know, his voice, you know, is, you know, one of the stars of the record, I think, you know, is particularly the use of falsetto and the layering of vocals. It's, you know, it's fun, but we're starting to get, you know, the backing track is, you know, taking us into the 90s with the mm-hmm. new Jack Swing. But again, you know, not quite as hip hoppy yet.
Right. All right. It's time for my clickbait headline to describe In Effect Mode. Before Color Me Bad needed 4 guys, Albie Shore did it solo.
Oh, yeah.
It reminded me a lot of what Color Me Bad was doing a couple of years later. It's one guy's vocals instead of 4 guys harmonizing. And
oh, yeah.
Although that has its pluses as well with the different personalities and stuff. This did kind of feel a lot like that record. You know, Color Me Bad influenced more, you know, with more hip hop beats and stuff, but kind of in the same ballpark.
Oh yeah, now that you say that, I could hear them singing these songs.
Yeah, yeah, and vice versa.
Right, and plus, didn't they kind of keep going to the same song on the album too?
Yes, yeah, they kept "I Adore Me Amore" kept coming back. Yeah, I think, or
"I Want to Sex You Up."
Or, "I Want to Sex You Up." I think there were a couple times that they did callbacks on that "Color Me Bad" album. But it's cohesive from front to back. It's like one long slow jam. The album here, Al's album, good sexy vibes, and it's like bedroom music if your bedroom door is made of beads.
Okay,
you know,
it's a young man's door.
That's right.
All right, Killer to Filler. Well, one song we should probably mention is there is a cover of Killing Me Softly, you know, which was made famous by Roberta Flack and then later made famous by the Fugees. That's an interesting version of it. And I wondered if maybe the Albie Shore version influenced the Fugees version.
I read that it didn't. They say that they were influenced by the Roberta Flack version. Al does turn it to her song instead of his song.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
right.
That's right.
And I don't know who he's referring to. Maybe Roberta herself.
That makes sense.
I liked "Ooh, This Love Is So." I don't like saying it, but I like the song.
You don't say it quite as smooth as Mr. Shore does.
But I like how it's sort of incomplete with the, you know, so with the dot, dot, dots. It's so what? You know, if you're in the mood to think while you're listening to something like this, you can, for yourself, like, what is it? You know, for your own, you know, situation or whatever. It's just built on a simple descending hypnotic bass loop, and it just, it's got a really nice vibe to it.
Yeah. I also like Naturally Mine kind of is has like that laid back vibe. I guess there's no like true ballads on the album because they're all
Killing Me Softly is the closest.
Yeah. Yeah. But they all sort of have that. It's not really down tempo, but it's not super up tempo. So it's that chill vibe.
Filler wise, Noche y Día is probably the only possibility there. I mean, 8 tracks wouldn't have been long enough really for an album. So It is kind of unnecessary, but it's kind of cool that it's there. Yeah. I wish they had had another song and maybe keep this as a bonus track, but it's a cohesive kind of just cool jam throughout. So there really isn't picking out songs as much as just picking up the vibes.
Right. Production, you know, like you said, it still carries on that do-it-yourself ethic. It doesn't feel unfinished or unpolished.
No, I don't know how it doesn't, but it doesn't. It sounds like it's stripped down deliberately. It's meant to be a feels record.
Yep.
I think.
Silky smooth. Mm-hmm. Replay value.
Yeah, it's like it's a front to back 38 minute setter or forgetter. And I know it's mainly remembered for Night and Day, but it's got an important role in that first wave of smooth R&B, new jack vibes. And I think it did have an impact. Again, one of those things where, I mean, they sold a couple million records, right? I mean,
sure.
It was successful, but more of a helping place foundations.
Yeah, I think this definitely has a place. You know, I'll return to it. I'm probably more likely to listen to it than Color Me Bad or even Belle Biv DeVoe. Right. I mean, it's much less crass than like a Belle Biv DeVoe record, you know? All right. Legacy.
I kind of hinted at it already with just its foundational piece in the sound, and I'll just leave it there.
Yeah. Around the same time, you've got like Keith Sweat doing that and the New Edition, Bobby Brown. And then Belle Biv DeVoe. We're starting to move into that direction.
The sound is almost in full effect. Get it?
Yeah, well done. Well done, sir. All right. Well, In Effect Mode catches a moment when R&B was shifting towards sleeker, more modern sounds, wrapping everyday romantic stories in shimmering keys and program grooves. Does that blend hit home for you? Cue it up and let us know.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time again for Deep Questions by Dom. All right. So, in the year 1988, were there any significant musical developments or moments?
Yes, there were. A handful, I would say, of significant. I mean, it really depends on where you were, if you were alive, and what you thought was significant. But for me, Yo MTV Raps premiering on MTV in 1988... It was the first television program dedicated entirely to hip-hop culture, hosted primarily by Fab Five Freddy and later Ed Lover and Dr. Dre. It brought rap videos, interviews, street culture in the millions of homes, and really did help push hip-hop into the front from a regional thing to more of a global force. I didn't have MTV, but trying to go over to my buddy's house, you know, making plans of, I didn't tell my parents why I was going, but it was to watch Yo MTV Raps.
Yeah, I think it really changed sort of the MTV playlist because, you know, prior to this, I mean, you weren't getting a lot of hip hop records. But I think what would happen is the record or the videos that would do well on Yo MTV Raps, they would eventually find their way onto the, you know, the main MTV playlist.
Yeah, it was smart, too, because one of the problems with MTV the first few years was it was very repetitive.
Mm-hmm. Very white.
And, yep. So having these programs that split off into little genres, then they could build an audience for something and then put it in the regular rotation.
Nice.
What about you, Donnie?
Well, this one, I mean, it's not really specific to 1988, but so karaoke music, I mean, that's actually something that, I mean, the idea of people singing at a bar, you know, goes back a long time. But, you know, both in the United States and in Japan, you had a lot of, you know, karaoke clubs and bars popping up. But in 1988, it really picked up steam because the do you remember Laserdisc technology?
I do.
So those were like these, for people who don't know, these were basically giant DVDs, right? So these predated DVDs. So almost like a record size.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they were 12 inches.
Right. And you could actually play both sides. But they started to have commercially or consumer grade karaoke machines that were on Laserdisc. So that way, you know, if you had the screen, you had the video and the words.
The words, yeah.
Yeah. And so then, you know, a DJ, if he, you know, bought one of these things, he or she could become a karaoke DJ.
Right. Yeah. And I know that is a passion of yours.
I enjoy it. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm the karaoke king or anything, but.
Do you have a signature karaoke song that you always do?
It changes. I have like a, you know, a semi-practice in the car, you know, but, but I do Don't You Forget About Me by Simple Minds. Because that's one, you got to do stuff people know.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, my brother-in-law has a signature tune.
What is it?
It's Save Tonight by Eagle Eye Terry.
That's good.
I make fun of him for that.
It's not the most vocally challenging, I suppose.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's an important part of it, though, is picking stuff that fits your range.
Right.
All right. What other musical developments and events happened in 1988? Let us know on our social media, like Instagram and Facebook, at Album Nerds.
So it's metal time.
Yes. My devil horns are ready.
This isn't really a devil horn situation for this album. The band is Queensryche, and the album is Operation Mindcrime.
Oh, yeah.
Queensryche is an American progressive metal band formed in 1980 in Bellevue, Washington. So Seattle area, I believe. Originally, Michael Wilton had a band called Joker that became Crossfire, then The Mob, and then shifted into Queensryche. Wilton on guitar, Chris DeGarmo also on guitar, Eddie Jackson on bass, Scott Rockenfield on drums, and Jeff Tate joined as lead vocalist in 1981.
Rockenfield's a good
it is.
Good name.
You gotta go into music if you got that name. The band chose the name Queensryche with the umlaut after their demo song, apparently called Queen of the Reich, modifying the spelling to avoid the Nazi connotations. Oh. But if you hear Reich, it still, you know, yeah, pops in your head. So that's why I kind of like avoided them as a kid, because it seemed like it was some skinhead thing, yeah. Which it totally isn't. Their early albums, The Warning from 84, The Rage for Order, were kind of commercially underperformed. Gothic image changes, and I guess Jeff Tate was more from a Depeche Mode sort of world type of thing. So,
right.
But eventually Q Prime Management, who managed Metallica, Def Leppard, got a hold of them, and things got better. So May 13th, 1988, the exact same day that Al B. Scherer released his album.
Big week.
Operation Mindcrime was released, produced by Peter Collins, their third studio album, recorded entirely on Sony 24-track digital tape, one of the first major metal albums to be fully digital. It peaked at number 50 on the Billboard 200, sold 3 million copies globally, spawned some singles, but it's about a 58-minute album, conceptual. It's got a big story. And I'm going to go through it really quick.
Okay.
Because the story is important to the songs. So we have a guy named Nikki, who's an addict and disillusioned drifter, gets recruited by this guy named Dr. X, who's like this shadowy demagogue. Nikki is brainwashed to turn into a political assassin. Nikki meets Sister Mary, a former prostitute turned nun, falls in love with her.
Mary Magdalene.
Dr. X orders Nikki to kill her. He refuses, but returns to find her dead. Nikki is arrested, institutionalized, with no memory of anything that happened, while Dr. X walks free, and the entire album is told in a flashback as Nikki recovers his memories from a hospital bed, ending where it began with him starting, you know, staring at a stranger in the mirror. Is that fair? Did I get it?
I think so.
Everything?
Yeah. Okay. That was my take on it.
All right. So we're going to hop into the first storytelling track, but it is the third track of the album. The first two set the scene. Track one, I remember now, is like a acted out spoken word thing where Nikki's in the hospital and the nurse is talking to him.
She calls him a bastard.
Yeah. Yes. Well, because he's a murdering assassin guy that's institutionalized. And then Anarchy X, which is sort of has this military march sound to it. And then that phases into our first song we're going to talk about, Revolution Calling. And we got some Maiden-esque vocal delivery here.
Yeah, and some priest driving rhythm, I think.
Yeah. Jeff Tate described getting genuinely psychotic inhabiting Dr. X's worldview during recording this song, having to fully believe it to sell it.
He's a method vocalist, I guess.
It is very performative, and I mean, you can just take them as metal tracks, but that one was written by Tate and Wilton. The lyrical theme's just grievances leading to the road to radicalization, right? This Nikki character is drawn to Dr. X's worldview and this revolution against, I think it was written in the Reagan era, politics, mm-hmm. media deregulation, televangelism, Iran-Contra, all that stuff was going on.
Yep.
So I think that was kind of the inspiration. And it does reflect what things are still happening sure. in society where, you know, and there's lines in here, you can't trust the media and all that kind of stuff. We all think this is new, but it's not new.
Right. Yeah, it's general enough that it's not of its time. You know, I mean, you could apply any of this revolutionary type talk to any era.
And then the Garmo and Wilton twin guitar stuff is really what drives this song and the whole album. Mm-hmm. Two guitarists sometimes playing together, sometimes accenting each other's sounds. It does make the songs more dynamic yes. and bigger. And that's the whole point here. These are all supposed to be big.
Yeah, I think between Tate's voice and the two guitars there, you know, they really take the show, steal the show.
Yes, they do steal the show. Speaking of the show, let's continue it with I believe this is just the next track where the scene is set for what Nikki's role is going to be in Dr. X's evil schemes, Operation Mindcrime. Love the pounding bass there. So essentially, this is when Dr. X, the operation becomes real, right? And that's what they're calling Operation Mindcrime, where Nikki's going to be off doing political assassinations or whatever. Mm-hmm. But apparently, the whole part of the story is that he'll get a call and he'll hear the word Mindcrime, and that turns him into this killing machine. And then the rest of the time, he's getting high or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's how the doctor is controlling him. So what'd you think about this? Is it all too much? I mean, we're four tracks in and it's a lot.
Yeah. I think there's enough, like musically it's, you know, just a hard rocking record so far, you know, with the metal vocals, but so there's enough there that, you know, even if you're not drawn in by the narrative, you know, it's still, you know, it gets your attention and keeps you going. So I think overall the album can be enjoyed on both levels. It's a huge, I mean, we did Hysteria last week. Mm-hmm. And there's a,
oh my God, what a difference.
Very different. I mean, it has things in common, you know,
sure.
Even vocally and, you know, some of the guitar riffs, but just completely different subject matter and I guess purpose.
Yeah. Hysteria is easier to digest because it just melts in your mouth.
You know? Sticky sweet.
Not in your hands. Don, there are so many songs here and so much to try to digest. What caught your ear?
Well, I always like to try to highlight like the really long track. So this one's a good 10 minutes or so, but it's called Sweet Sister Mary. This is a pretty pivotal point in the narrative, which we'll get to in a moment.
Okay.
I feel the rain coming down. My face feels wet. My mind's storm.
This feels like a moment where Phantom of the Opera or something. Where
I
am so sad.
Yeah, so
he's good. He is a good music actor.
Oh yeah, I mean his voice. He's got quite a voice and quite a range, and he's very dramatic. He could have played Phantom, certainly.
I've never seen it, but I'll take your word for it.
So that part we just heard there comes from the opening section. I think Dr. X tells Nikki to kill Mary. And so that's what he's dealing with there, coming to the realization that he's supposed to kill her.
And it's just because she's a distraction, right? Because he's fallen in love with her and he's starting to doubt his mission.
Right. Yes. Yep.
And Sister Mary's character is quite complicated as well. But, you know,
yeah,
we don't need to get into that right now.
Well, so this first part is very atmospheric and it has sort of like Catholic.
Yeah, that Latin mass. Fetus Dominus type stuff going on.
Then the middle part gets a little more traditional metal. You know, the tempo picks up. And then, you know, the closing, you know, kind of returns to that sort of choral vibe. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, at this point, Nikki, you know, I guess chooses not to kill Mary, which is a problem.
Yes. Yeah, so Michael Kamen is involved here, scoring movies like Die Hard and things like that, but also later known for working with Metallica on the S&M project.
Sure.
But yeah, so we definitely have some big movie cinematic, all that stuff you're talking about, the choral stuff, but the strings and like it is, it's big. It's a big song and it's a sweet, Sister Mary, S-U-I-T-E.
Yep.
So it is like three songs in one in a way. But yeah, it's big stuff. Monks singing and the whole shebang.
Oh yeah, and the monks are called like the Moronic Monks Choir or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is cool. He's also supposed to kill the priest in here or something too, right?
Because priest is already been dispatched.
Sorry. Yes.
Yeah, it's a lot, people.
Yeah, but it's actually not as bad as some of the other like rock operas we've had to translate.
It is a much more linear story, and it is like start to finish, it is clearer.
Yes,
if you know what the basic story structure, you can follow it. And a lot of times in concept albums, they go off the rails and try and bring you back later. So let's close this thing out with this is what track. 18, 15. Eyes of a Stranger. And I raise my head. So this one was written by DeGarmo Tate. This is the first charting U.S. hit for the band, actually. Album kind of ends where it begins. Nicky's in the hospital. Now his memory's been restored, and he's staring at a stranger in the mirror, you know, like, what the hell have I done?
Mm-hmm. Been there.
We all have done. The last words on the album are, I remember now. And the story doesn't really... Like, did he kill Mary? Didn't he kill Mary? He thinks maybe he did. Mm-hmm. And I guess they resolve it years later, like in a live performance of it, they answer whether he did or didn't. And from what I read, the answer then was that she killed herself to save him from having to compromise himself like that.
Oh, I like that. I mean, I don't like that she killed herself, but.
Right. But, you know, he's been radicalized, used, discarded, and now he's incarcerated basically, and it was all for nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, and the bad guy got away.
Yeah,
Dr. X escapes. So what'd you think about this one, man?
Yeah, I think it's a great ending to the album. You know, when you do a rock opera or whatever you want to call it, a concept album, I think it's important to end, you know, in a significant way or kind of build to it. I do kind of see this as like the definitive track on the album. Yeah, it's really good. And his voice is just incredible. And the guitars sound great. It's a good track.
It's very powerful. Yeah. And I'm surprised this hasn't been made into a movie or series or something or comic book. Maybe it has. I don't know.
Yeah.
But all right. Well, it's a lot to rewind and reflect on, but let's try doing that for Operation Mindcrime. I'll start off with my clickbait headline to describe the album. What if Pink Floyd made a metal album about the Reagan era and it accidentally predicted the political future but didn't see grunge coming?
Ooh. I'm glad you mentioned Pink Floyd first.
It's a cover-to-cover experience. This is not a shuffle album. No. This is not... I mean, there's a couple of songs I guess you could pluck out for a playlist, but the segues, the dialogue, it all interlocks the narrative, and it feels more like a film score than a metal record. It's 58 minutes. Which isn't that bad,
no,
considering how much is covered. But years ago on the show, I believe Andy and I talked about this. Don, you were completely new to this, yes?
Yes.
So why don't you give us your overall vibe? I'm interested.
All right. Well, my clickbait headline is, no silent lucidity here, just loud paranoia. So yeah, my only experience with Queensryche was, silent lucidity was a big video on MTV. Yeah, which also had a very Pink Floyd-y vibe.
Yeah, I think even more consistently Floyd-y than any of the songs on this.
Yeah, yeah, it was like a Comfortably Numb kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then that album was Empire. I remember hearing other tracks from that. So I kind of knew what to expect, but I was still, you know, pleasantly surprised. It's a very intelligent metal album, I think, but it still has all of the important elements of metal, you know, so it's still fun. You can bang your head to it at times, but it also makes you think, but it's not so nerdy and dorky.
No,
you know,
no. The way that it's told is just like, you know, in this song, we get to know Sister Mary. In this song, you know, like it's easy.
Right. And there's no demons. There's no witches. There's
right. The only evil is human.
Right. Yeah. It's an accessible story. It's not a fantasy thing where like a lot of progressive music goes towards. Like,
yeah. So killer to filler. It's a tough one because you really need everything.
Yeah.
Spreading the Disease, I thought, was one of the strongest. This is the one where we kind of get to know Mary. She was a prostitute, is taken in by this priest. She becomes a nun, but he defiles her and stuff regularly. So he's, you know, it everything is twisted, right? Like no one is fixed in this mm-hmm. world, in this story. But it has this sort of this five simultaneous meanings of the word disease. You know, the disease of addiction is covered, mm-hmm. the disease of ideology,
right.
Institutional corruption, sex work, and the media as a disease vector. Like I've seen this song pulled apart into a lot of different directions.
Yeah.
And you don't have to view it that way. You can just view it as the terrible story of who Mary is and then how Nikki falls in love with her and they find each other in these horrifying situations where they're both prisoners of their missions.
Yeah. Yeah. Another cut I like is Speak. I mean, I love the refrain, the speak to me. You know,
that's your, yeah. And that one certainly has the Bruce Dickinson, Iron Maiden vibes like all over it, which I do love. This Jeff Cat can really sing.
Yep. And I think that song is he discovering that he can be sort of a political mouthpiece or something? Or I don't know if he's talking about himself or Dr. X sort of riling people up. But that's a great. Actually, I mean, the first side of the record, it's just all bangers right in a row, you know, just up tempo. Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. You know, on side two, I Don't Believe in Love, I think, is another standout cut.
Grammy nominated, lost to Metallica's One.
Oh, that's a good battle.
This one could be stripped of the concept and work as a power ballad on its own, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then fillers, I mean, it really depends on your taste. Like, do we need Anarchy X and Electric Requiem and stuff?
It kind of sets the tone for the record.
It does. But could you get by with just the rock songs?
Sure, probably.
But again, like I said, for being 58 minutes, I think it's worth listening to all of it.
I agree.
If it were an hour and a half, I'd say, okay, we can trim it, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's necessary because it's a quick journey and it's a big one. Production. Good God. Peter Collins imparted the Rush sound. I guess he had worked with Rush. Mm-hmm. Enormous, precise drum echoing. And this was one of the first, I think I mentioned, major metal albums recorded on the 24-track digital tape. So it's precise. Mm-hmm. But I guess it was so precise, they intentionally warmed it up a little bit in post-production because it was too hard, too cold.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, because they do a good job. Like, it doesn't seem overproduced.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't. It seems as gritty as the what you're picturing, all the wet cathedrals and dirty streets. It all, the soundscape fits the narrative. DeGarmo, I think, is a chronically underrated guitar player. He's, you know, the clean arpeggios, the razor riffs, but he plays lap steel, 12-string acoustic, guitar synth, and it all serves the story. And there's just some great guitar work on this album. And because of the story and Jeff's big vocals, I don't think DeGarmo gets enough credit for what's created here. Replayability for you? Are you going back?
Yes. Yeah. I love stuff like this. You know, I mean, as a fan of The Wall, you know, I mean, this is, you know, right up my alley. And it's also, you know, I think it'll be a good conversation piece with when I talk to like metal fans or, you know, people who like music of this era. Yeah. I love Jeff Tate's voice. I love the guitar work. You know, there's.
Well, and it's an opportunity to someone who thinks that metal is hokey. Mm-hmm. This is a good opportunity to give them something big to experience and maybe score some credibility points.
I think it is more accessible than Iron Maiden.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. It's not an entry point album. I mean, you got to be ready to put the headphones on and commit an hour to it, but I think it's worth it. So legacy-wise, what are your thoughts here?
Well, I think it's probably important in just continuing like metal concept albums, like being a thing, you know, because we've done what The Sword and Mastodon, you know, all these concept albums. And I think this probably helped establish that, you know, that idea.
What you could do, how far can you take it? Yeah. It's praised as a conceptual milestone in metal, and it's compared to the brilliance of things like Quadrophenia by The Who and Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. I don't know if you take umbrage with that, Don, as a Pink Floyd fan, but does it reach those heights?
I probably not, but it's but it's good. I mean, I'm glad that they're aspiring to that kind of thing.
Right. But it did. The bad part is it became a milestone for the band. It kind of overshadowed everything that came after, right? I mean, how do you move forward and just do a rock record after this?
Yeah, I heard even stuff. On the Empire tour, they actually were performing this entire album.
Oh, well, there you go. All right. If you want an 80s metal album that hits like a movie and thinks like a novel, Operation Mindcrime is the one. Check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
All right, so this week, you know, you were turned into a grown-up for a little while, but then you turned back into a kid. Is that right?
What the hell are you? Oh,
Big. Wow. Yes.
The movie Big with Tom Hanks. Good, good reveal.
So on the way back from the Zotar machine, did you have a chance to dig anything else?
Indeed. And I am back in child form. So, favorite band of mine that's been around for, God, I can't believe it, over 20 years. They started when they were teenagers. The Sheepdogs, Keep Out of the Storm is the new album. The Sheepdogs are a Saskatchewan-formed rock band known for their retro 70s sort of sound, rich vocal harmonies, guitar-driven mix of classic rock, soul, and country influences. I love them. I've enjoyed them since early 2000s. The new one continues their roots rock revivalism. Why don't we listen to a little bit of the title track, Keep Out of the Storm. Alright, so, you know, it's got Southern rock swagger. They haven't changed their vibe or sound, but every record is still fun to listen to, so I do recommend that one.
Sounds very good.
And then, of course, it is 1988 here on our I Love the 80s journey, so I had to try and pick something from my collection. I don't have a ton of albums from 1988, apparently, but I do have Living Colors Vivid, which we did talk about on the show a while back. Living Color New York formed rock band, blending hard rock, funk, metal, socially conscious lyrics, led by guitarist Vernon Reid and powerhouse vocalist Corey Glover, known largely for this song, Cult of Personality. An infectious, impossible not to groove to song. I think anybody hears that riff and it's go time. Doesn't matter what your taste is. And that's a big deal. Yeah, it's there's lots of genre blending here.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very 88 in its neon feel.
It also has kind of pre-grunge vibes.
Yeah, it do. I don't know why I said it do.
It do.
But it certainly do. I stand by it. Don, what you been digging?
I guess because of, you know, other things I've been digging, Tidal keeps suggesting stuff sort of out of this like shoegaze genre. So one group I discovered, they're called Pink Breath of Heaven.
Okay.
Which is a fun name. The album's called Color Makes a Sound. They're from San Francisco. It's lead singer and guitarist Liv Field, you know, working along with her guitarist Rex John Shelverton. So here's a track called The Wind Is Calling.
I'm not sure if you're still there, Don. I'm looking at my shoes. I'm gazing at them. I think we talked about this before, but I did read that shoegaze came from like the effects pedals that the musicians are looking at their feet all the time. It's not that people are being mopey and looking at their feet at their shoes.
Right.
Yeah. I hope that's true. I like that.
No, I do. Yeah, that's what I heard as well. So yeah, you know, it's not too sleepy or anything. You know, like it's got, you know, like an edge to it, and you know, some rough edges. So it's been a good listen so far. And then another one, the band Social Distortion, which has been around forever, mainly the vehicle of singer and guitarist Mike Ness. They have an album coming out later this year in May, but they did release the opening cut and title track. It's called Born to Kill.
Sounds like Social Distortion.
Yeah. Yeah, sort of a... I never really know exactly where to classify Social Distortion. You know, I mean, I guess they're kind of post-punk, but maybe even more just punk, but...
Yeah, I guess I'd call them neopunk. We can throw all kinds of shit at the beginning or end of punk to describe things.
Yeah, there's always kind of like a protesty vibe or something, I think, with the music too. But looking forward to hearing what's new from Mike Ness. So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Album Nerds.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about time on the show when I'm reminded of the words of Cleo McDowell, played by James Amos in 1988's Coming to America. Yeah, great movie. So Cleo McDowell says, "Look, me and the McDonald's people got this little misunderstanding. See, they're McDonald's. I'm McDowell's. They got the Golden Arches. Mine is the Golden Arcs. They got the Big Mac. I've got the Big Mick. We both got 2 all beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, and onions, but their buns have sesame seeds. My buns have no seeds." With that in mind, that was a long one. Yeah. Let's bring out the Wheel of Musical Discovery to find out what kind of albums we'll be discovering in 1989.
Next time, we wrap up our I Love the 80s series with 1989. New sounds rise to the surface as we dive into alternative and hip-hop, spotlighting 2 albums that hint at the musical shifts just around the corner in the next decade.
Cool. Hip-hop and alternative, which is starting to emerge here at the end of the end of the 80s.
Seems like an appropriate choice for the final year.
Yeah, those two genres go into the 90s. Strong.
All right. Well, what's your favorite records from 1989 and 1988? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com or follow us on Instagram and our other social media at Album Nerds. And you can visit albumnerds.com to listen to all 328 episodes. And the best way to support this show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you so much for joining us here on the Album Nerds podcast. Mind crime. So everyone's going to run out doing terrible stuff now. The code word has been released. All right. We'll see you next time in 89.
All right. This one, unfortunately, you're going to get right away because I couldn't figure out how to do the Roseanne theme. You know, so that one. I don't do a good, like, harmonica or whatever.
So TV theme.
Yes.
I have to guess.
Yes.
Here we go. From 88.
Yes.
What would you do if I said... The Wonder Years. Come on.
Yes.
Have you watched that recently? They I think there's a copyright problem. They have to replace somebody, the Joe Cocker version with some other dude.
Somebody else. I hope that the episodes aren't like that, too. You know, because the music was so important, I think.
Yeah. But believe, I watched part of one episode, and it seemed like the stuff in the show was intact.
Okay, good.
So just as we look back on the 80s, the Wonder Years look back on the 60s.
Well, that's true. That's true.
I think they called it I Love the 60s. That's what I should have done. All right, see y'all next time. 89, end of a decade.